Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. Learn more at nm.org/better.
Monday morning health briefs now with us this week, the chief medical officer at Northwestern Medicine's Northwest Region of Hospitals, Dr. Irfan Hafiz. Doctor, good morning. We're getting into the sniffling season, so this is a good time to talk about if you really should feed a cold and starve a fever. Truth to that or not?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, we're getting into that time of the year. No, I would say no. I think it's really kind of an old wives' tale there. Though, I think there's a little asterisk next to that. You know, you definitely don't want to starve yourself either when, you know, you're sick. You want to make sure you're getting some adequate nutrition. And then maybe some foods preferred to others, you know, more, you know, that's giving you just general relief. You know, soups and stuff, with the steam and the heat there, helping soothe your throat or some congestion. I think it does go a long way in providing some comfort while you're recovering.
Yeah, you want your body to fight off the sickies, but what if you have no appetite for a day or two? Are you supposed to force yourself to eat something?
No, and that's a great point. On the other side is that, you know, really you shouldn't be forcing yourself. However, you don't want to be, you know, starving yourself either. And especially when people have a fever, the big thing they get into is dehydration. So it's making sure that you're keeping up on fluids, taking, even if you can't take a lot of fluids down, take a little bit of a sip, but do it frequently. And try to have some basic food in there. Even if it's just a little bit of bread or a little bit of rice or some fruit or something, it's fine. That way you're getting a little bit of calories in you.
There was some research I saw recently, and it was about honey, and pretty positive, wasn't it?
Yeah, and again, it's just the soothing effect that some of these foods have at that, especially, you know, having some tea and stuff with some honey can definitely go a long way.
Let's talk about the study that just came out about cholesterol and alternatives beyond statins. What was the takeaway from this?
Yeah, so, you know, statins have, so we know quite a bit about cholesterol and its effects on heart disease and stroke, and that management of that cholesterol can improve the risks of getting those diseases. So really, you know, it's really important to focus on that cholesterol. Statins have been really a miraculous group of drugs, but not everyone can take them. And for some people, they need even more because of genetic factors that are there. So there are some of these classes of drugs. There's one of them that they're PCSK9 inhibitors. They're injectable, which is different than your statins, which can be taken as pills. These need to be taken as a shot, but they're very, very effective at lowering your cholesterol. So if you're having issues with either statins, you can't take them, or it's still not enough, speak to your doctor if these other drugs may be an option.
Are most of these drugs that were mentioned in this study available now?
Well, there's a couple of them that are available now, and I think there's more coming down the road. I think one of the other advantages, well, one advantage is that the mechanism is different, so they're not a substitute for the statins, but they may actually enhance the effect of the statins. The other thing is that some of the drugs are just once a month, so it's great that you don't have to take a pill every day. You could take a shot once a month, and you're done.
Do you think statins have been, in some cases, overprescribed? People kind of on the borderline of high cholesterol are advised to take the statins. What do you think?
Actually, I'm kind of in the camp where they're probably underprescribed. They're
really
actually so highly effective. Yes, they're very, very highly effective drugs. Some side effects, but they're pretty minimal. And we've managed to use them now for almost 15, 20 years. And they have clearly shown to improve outcomes on patients. It's quite remarkable how much it is. And there's certain groups, especially if you have family history of disease, strongly would recommend talking to your doctor about it.
So at some point, improving your diet and exercise regime won't help, right? You get to that point sometimes?
That's a great point. And a lot of people will feel that they can just exercise or diet their way. But the important point, though, is, yes, those do help, but certain genetics also can cause our body to produce the bad cholesterol, even if we have none in our diet. And it's really when you get to that point that no further diet or exercise is going to be helpful. And that's where these drugs really have remarkable benefit. So especially if you're diabetic, absolutely need to consider these.
Dr. Irfan Hafiz is the Chief Medical Officer of Northwestern Medicine's Northwest Region of Hospitals. Doctor, let's talk about kidney health. We were very saddened around here to hear of the passing of Jim Avila, the veteran broadcast journalist, spent a lot of time here in Chicago. He had a kidney transplant. Eventually, that failed. And there is some new research now on immune reactions that may explain why organs get rejected. What do we know about this?
So, kidney disease obviously is a fairly common condition there. And one of the treatments is to transplant. And the limitation there is to find a match. We always hear about, someone needed to be a match. And you need the match so that the person receiving the transplant is able to tolerate the new organ that they're, the kidney that they're getting in this case. But when there's a bigger genetic difference, it is harder and harder. And so you need very powerful drugs to reduce the rejection. Now, one of the problems is because you need the match, there's a very limited number of organs, and that's why people end up on waiting lists for a long time. But in this study, what they looked at is looking at something like a pig kidney, which is of similar size to a human kidney. How could that be used without the rejection? And in this study, they actually were able to change some of the genetics and the markers on the pig kidney so that the human that was receiving that transplant doesn't perceive it as being a foreign species, a different species there, and doesn't have the same rejection. So it really does open the possibility of transplant lists being almost gone, people being able to get transplants, also with vastly reduce immunosuppressive drugs. So this is like the holy grail of transplants, and if this can be done, we're still probably a few years away from it. This could really be a game changer.
Yeah, sounds like a huge step forward. Ultra processed foods, we know they're bad for us, but in a study that was published last week, it looks like they're even worse than we thought. What did this research tell us?
Yeah, in this particular study, what they looked at, the people they followed their diets and they looked at their colonoscopies, and they did find that people who had diets that were heavy in ultra-processed foods tended to have more polyps and precancerous. This does not mean that these foods are causing cancer, but they did see more precancerous polyps there. And therefore, and we do know that polyps can occur because of, dietary habits there. So some modification of that will help. And one of the things I think that's important is that ultra-processed foods have high sugar and low fiber. So it's probably a combination of reducing the sugars, increasing the fiber in the diet that goes a long way in helping this.
So we're talking about potato chips, packaged baked goods, things like that?
Yeah, soda drinks, packaged goods, as you said, muffins, cookies, donuts, instant foods. And one of the things is because in order to have something, right off the shelf that's edible, has a long shelf life, or can just be minimally heated, it does tend to have higher sugars, low fiber, and a lot of preservatives. So having foods that are less ready to eat tend to be not in that ultra-processed.
Why can't the pleasure centers of our brain crave salads? Instead, we want all the things you just mentioned.
Exactly.
By the way, getting back to the study on ultra-processed foods, the rates of colorectal cancer in people under 50 have risen sharply in recent decades. The findings in this study have any give us any clues as to why?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things on that. One is probably diet there, but also it is, more awareness of screening. More people are getting screened, so we're finding some of these adenomas earlier and earlier. But also it's family history of that as well. Mm-hmm. So, paying attention to that, definitely at the age of 45, please get your colonoscopy earlier. If you have a family history, talk to your doctor. These screenings do save lives.
One thing we should be adding to our diet, apparently, selenium-rich foods. What do we know about this?
Yeah, so selenium is a micronutrient, so it's, you know, you really don't need a lot of it, but it does help a lot with immune function and so on there. But being that micronutrient, you know, it is also important that we don't overdo that. So most normal diets do contain enough selenium. Things like nuts have them. So just a little bit of that, you know, in your diet should be fine. Overdoing it actually can produce some bad effects. So you really don't need, unless your doctor's recommending, you don't need to take a separate supplement for it.
Tuna has it, right? Tuna, eggs.
Tuna does. Eggs has it. Turkey has it. You know, things like that. Do you have plenty of selenium in them?
All right. We know what to add to the breakfast now. Thanks to you, Dr. Irfan Hafiz. Have a good one.
Thank you.